League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Cuando compras una blusa y falda ultra chic en JCPenney por tan solo $60, no solo estás comprando una blusa y falda ultra chic en JCPenney por tan solo $60, estás comprando la mirada de todas las mamás del colegio por tan solo $60. La prueba está en el recibo. Sí, es JCPenney. El precio incluye el 20% de descuento con el cupón. Oferta válida hasta el 2 de agosto. Detalles en la tienda o jcp.com.
What are we starting with this week?
A review comment, a YouTube comment.
YouTube comment, yes, is correct. Actually, two YouTube comments. So there, one of them is a reply to the other. This one is from our cult episode from late last year. It says, "I would join Luke's cult, no questions asked." And the response is, "Not asking questions is probably key." Which is true. Yeah.
I have a very philosophically consistent cult. Thank you very much.
And if you want to join the Sci Guys cult, don't forget to check out our merch at normalcitizen.store. There might still be some kicking around. And if
it's
there's
the entry
not,
requirements.
We'll be making some more.
Yeah.
You got to have all the merch
to
join
to get
the cult.
Yeah.
Also to get into heaven. Not Sci Guys heaven. All of the heavens. The Christian one. We've made Jewish heaven now. You gotta get Sci Guys merch to get in there too. You don't reincarnate unless you got Sci Guys merch.
In the Sci Guys cult.
Absolutely. The Buddha didn't reach enlightenment. No. Reach Sci Guys
merch.
He didn't
snag one of our cool beanies.
Let's start the show.
There's a question. Oh, God, I'm so bad at this.
So my question for everyone is, what's your favorite number? Let us know in the comments of the YouTube video what your favorite number is. If you're on Spotify or Apple or any other audio platform, head over to YouTube. Leave a comment. We've got a lot of other stuff going on just outside this podcast, don't we? Plenty of different shows. Loads of different things. Go there and check it out. Shall we start the show now?
Let's start the show.
Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jamp, and Luke Cutforth is taking off his jacket.
He is.
Hello, Luke Cutforth, taking off his jacket. Down.
This week we're talking about denial, and anger, and bargaining, and depression, and acceptance.
Ah, the seven dwarves.
Is this grief? The seven dwarves.
No, that's Snow White and the seven. There was five. There was five things there.
Well, maybe there's two more.
Snow White and the five stages of grief.
I mean... That would work. She does go through the five stages of grief in that film. Fun fact. Yeah. Shall we maybe get into what the five stages of grief are?
Sure.
Why don't instead of me giving you a little overview of what I think the five stages of grief are, or what I know the five stages of grief are, because I've researched it, why don't you give me a quick overview of what you both think the five stages of grief are, Jamp?
Well, you just told us.
There's dopey.
No.
There's sleepy.
No,
there's,
Jamp.
There's deady, and then that's how Snow White has to grieve.
I don't mean the five stages. I mean just generally what they mean. Yeah, what the whole deal is. What's the deal with the five stages of grief? What does it mean?
First I have to remember that. Oh, it's just as a concept.
Yeah, it's a concept.
Right, so the five stages of grief is an idea that everybody who goes through loss goes through these, I guess, five stages of grieving, which all entail different patterns of behavior or like feelings, I guess. I don't know.
That's pretty spot on as to what people think the five stages of grief are.
Yes. Yes.
They would be wrong.
So you're pretty spot on there. That's a little teaser for later on in the episode. Let's first hop right into grieving and bereavement. The most fun way to start an episode, don't you think?
Mm.
Yeah. Let's get some big smiles on for
Feel
grieving
good 2022.
Jesus, Luke.
Smiling through the pain.
Oh God.
Tickle me. So, what is bereavement?
Is it mourning?
No. Mourning is when the sun
comes
up.
Mourning
and bereavement. They're related concepts, but they're not the same thing actually. So I'm going to tell you what bereavement is, and I actually learned this just whilst researching this episode, which I think is pretty interesting. A bereavement means to be robbed or to be deprived of something valuable. We often use it, obviously, to specifically talk about death. You know, you've got a bereavement, as in you had someone go ahead and get the skeleton man, steal them. They died.
Yeah.
Death is a skeleton man. Trying to make it lighthearted.
By bringing up death.
Yeah. You know.
The skeletons aren't very nice.
It was a really lighthearted show. You know, The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy. It was fun.
What is that? You keep on bringing up shows I've never seen. Is that another Disney show?
It's a Cartoon Network show, actually.
Oh, God. Check your privilege, man. I had Cartoon Network for 1 month of my entire childhood.
Well, you should have watched The Grim Adventures of Billy and, Billy and Mandy then.
I was too busy watching Dexter's Lab.
That's a good one as
well. You failed to take full advantage.
Yeah. Well, don't blame me for your poor... Actually, Dexter's Lab is quite good, so it's not poor taste. Just narrow taste. Also, it doesn't take a month to watch Dexter's Lab, I'll tell you that. So, we know what bereavement is. It's the sort of loss, essentially, right? Bereavement is the loss, and you can express bereavement through, like, acts of mourning. And acts of mourning are the sort of, like, they're the kind of ways that you say, I have lost someone, I am feeling sad, and this is what I am doing. I am mourning, right? You're basically, like...
Interesting.
Yeah, it's mourning is that sort of, like... is the sort of almost the action, right? Mm-hmm. Of like what you do when you've had a bereavement.
Do you have any examples?
Oh, I'll get to them in a second.
Okay.
And it makes more sense if I explain to you what grieving is. And grieving is the sort of experience of bereavement. It's the psychological experience of bereavement. So the feelings that you get when you've lost something. So
I honest to God thought that bereavement was the period of time in which you go through mourning.
So you've got a period of mourning.
Yeah.
But bereavement is...
I thought that was basically synonymous with bereavement. Interesting.
Yeah, no, I didn't know the distinction between these three words either.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like as I said, bereavement is the sort of like, is the loss. Grieving is the emotional experience of bereavement. Like kind of like how thunder is the sound of lightning, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then I guess mourning is the act of grieving, right? The actions that you take when you're grieving. So mourning could be like, you know, you have a funeral. That's part of mourning.
Mm-hmm.
There was like the period of mourning for like Victorian ladies, I'm pretty sure, which was like, you know, they'd wear black and they'd be all depressed or whatever. I think Mary Shelley carried her husband's heart in a bloody like jar.
Oh,
whatever. That was her thing. She was weird. Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of an overview of those three concepts. Yeah. You think you got them?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll give you an example of grieving, for example, right? So, grief. So, grief. I experienced grief when the latest Star Wars film came out, and it was really, really disappointing.
It was awful.
And there was a really great story.
You entered into a period of mourning.
I genuinely, yeah. I am not, I need to be totally clear here. This is not a joke. I had a period of mourning when The Rise of Skywalker came out,
yes,
and The Last Jedi set up such an amazing film, and
I had the same thing.
Just, yeah, exactly.
The Last Jedi for me was the best Star Wars film of all time.
Same.
And I had such high hopes for the last film, and it was just, it just had to be the worst one ever.
And all the plot threads were dropped, and basically wiped the slate clean, like basically swept The Last Jedi completely away, like swept it under the rug.
Even bits like actively, like,
yeah,
dumping on The Last Jedi,
yeah,
undoing certain things, symbolically undoing certain actions,
removing like certain characters that should have been in it, making Finn and Poe like aggressively heterosexual for no reason.
Yeah,
I genuinely went through a period of mourning, and I have experienced a loss in the family, and I would say that Star Wars was not on par, but oh boy,
far surpassed.
That stuck with me for a long. That stuck with me for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I'm glad I could finally get it out.
I still haven't reached acceptance.
I think I'm almost there.
Almost there.
I genuinely remember a New Year's party where I spoke to two friends for about an hour about this.
You gotta get out, man.
So
get it all out.
What's thanatology?
The study of Thanos.
Okay, no. It's the study of Thanatos.
Which
is
different from Thanos.
Which is
Thanados is two Thanos.
We're talking about the five stages of grief. What does Thanos do?
Kills people.
Uh-huh. So Thanatos.
The study of death.
Yeah.
Ah.
Bingo. So it comes from the Greek Thanatos, which I believe is... I handed you the answer.
Teamwork.
But we still got it.
Okay, fine. So it comes from the Greek Thanatos, which I believe is a Greek god. I think Thanatos was one of the grandfather of Zeus or something. Mm. I think he's the one that was like fully eating his kids.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure. Lovely. Someone okay. will probably correct me in the comments if I'm wrong on that, because my knowledge of Greek mythology is...
You get a free actually pass right now. If you want to correct...
Greek mythology nerds, get in chat.
You have to open the comments and write actually, comma, and then correct Corey's Greek mythology knowledge.
Actually only has a comma after the actually. No. Actually, you cannot actually me if I'm opening you up for a correction. That is my... That's what drives me up the wall.
Yeah, well, I'm one third of Sci Guys as well. I say you can. Actually, they can. What do you think?
I agree with nobody.
Okay.
Which it means you agree with Odysseus? It means nobody?
Yeah, man.
Right?
I really hope so, or you're getting another correction.
Actually is in chat if he's wrong.
I studied Latin and ancient Greek with the same teacher, so all of it is kind of like into one.
Yeah.
Let's move on. I'm pretty sure that Thanatos is also the origin for Thanos' name, which makes sense, because his whole thing in the comics is he wanted to get it on with Lady Death. She was a sexy skeleton lady, and he wanted her real bad.
Yeah.
Genuinely, Luke. That is the motivation for Thanos in the comics. Wait till you get to Endgame and Infinity War and see how different they made it in the films.
Well, yeah, I'm quite glad they made it different.
I would have liked to see a couple films where a big
Thanos
purple guy,
a skeleton,
yeah, a big purple guy kills half the universe because he wants to have sex with a living pile of lady bones.
Yeah.
Like, that just seems far more compelling, don't you think? Mm. He did it for love. So. Moving on from Thanatos, so the thanatology, obviously the study of death. I just thought that was an interesting thing to bring up there. But you know the other name for the five stages of grief, right? Do you know the more sort of the more sort of technical name for it? No,
being a wuss.
No.
Whoa.
No,
sorry.
So it's not being a wuss, Jamp. I know you said it was being a wuss, but actually, it's named after Elizabeth Kubler Ross, not Elizabeth Wuss, Jamp. It's the Kubler-Ross method, not the Wuss method.
The Kubler-Ross method.
Sorry, I was focusing too much on Jamp saying that people that go through the five stages of grief are wusses.
I said method.
That's true. I actually am pretty hung
up on
that.
Watch the episode
too.
Back.
I think I
did
have
not
to
say
go
that.
Through the five stages of grief on just the fact that he said that.
Oh, yeah,
I don't know why you're putting words. People can watch the episode.
Said
I didn't
what?
Say it.
He said that people who are going through grief are
wusses. Kubler-Ross model.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not saying it again. I've made my correction for my wrong.
Kubler-Ross model. So like a model of grieving.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, a theoretical model. Like, like, it's not like someone built
a little model,
model of grief.
Just the five little models of grief.
Yes.
Acceptance.
No.
A tick.
So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Now I'll just give you a quick overview of her life because it's actually quite interesting and we could maybe do an episode on her at some point. Maybe. I don't know. And we'll just skim over. She was born in Switzerland in 1926, which is a long time ago.
Is she dead?
Nearly a century.
Yes. Oh. She died, I think, in...
I hope her family are over it.
Her family also, probably.
There are nicer ways to say that.
I do hope that they are... Well, I hope they're not still grieving. That would be sad. That'd be a bad thing for them.
I don't know when she died. Then. She could have died like 10 minutes ago.
That's true.
I got a text. I was keeping in contact. No, she died 18 years ago. Almost August 2004.
That's more recent than I would have expected.
Well, she was born in 1926.
You said born, and then in my head I was like,
died.
Everything that you're about to talk about took place in 1926.
She did it.
So
all
in my head, she was born an adult in 1926.
She did it all as a little tiny baby.
Kubler-Ross model.
Before she even got married to Ross, it was just
models of Play-Doh.
So Kubler-Ross, she was born Elizabeth. I think she was born Elizabeth Kubler. That makes sense. Yeah, yeah. She was born Elizabeth Kubler, and so in Switzerland, as I said. gosh, this is all over the place. She worked as a relief worker in Poland, sort of after World War II. She went to a concentration camp in Majdanek, and she saw these butterflies carved on the walls, and that really like hit her. She was like, wow, this is gonna be real bad. Oh gosh. She thought, wow, all these children were being killed and they still carved butterflies. Isn't that wonderful?
Oh
yeah, you know, like all these kids going through this awful thing, and they still found the time to carve butterflies into the walls. I forgot that I wrote this, by the way. So she said, I've got a quote here. She said, it was incomprehensible to me. Thousands of children going into the gas chamber, and this is the message they leave behind, a butterfly. That was really the beginning. And so she wanted to then, after seeing that, she wanted to look into life, death, and that sort of whole area of study. And she started studying medicine in 1951. So she started training to basically be a doctor. And then she went into sort of psychology. She also met her husband while studying medicine. Her husband was American. His name was Emmanuel Ross.
Great name.
That's the Ross from Cooper Ross. Ross.
Oh.
Yeah, so that was her surname then. She had a double-barreled surname. She came up with this by herself, by the way. So yeah, it was
her
a woman.
Surname.
No husband required.
She came up with the five stages of grief by herself. And yes, it was a woman that came up with the five stages of grief. I feel like that's something that isn't necessarily brought up often enough. We often, especially at that period of time, it's often men that sort of do these things. And this was a woman. It's just a shame that it's not necessarily empirically supported. We'll get to that.
Oh, no.
We'll get to it. So, you know, she met her husband, took his name and kept her own as well, because she's a boss. And she started studying sort of psychiatry. 1965, she had a teaching. She started teaching at the University of Chicago, the University of Chicago Medical School. And she started teaching seminars on death and dying. And she had extensive interviews with terminally ill people. So she was in there chatting to him. And it was in this sort of like, it was over this time where she was like chatting to terminally ill people like constantly that she started writing her her book. Or the most famous book that she's written, actually. I think she's written over 20 books or like 25 books. But this was her most famous one that was published in 1969. It's called On Death and Dying. And that was where she brought up for the first time the five-stage model of grief. And we'll go through what the five stages are in a little bit more depth in a second. Yeah, so she published more than 20 books about death, grief, the afterlife. And then she left academia in 1977 because her workshops, her books and all of that, her talks were making enough money that she could leave academia. And she founded Shanti Nilaya, Final Home of Peace in California. And that was supposed to be the sort of center for people that were terminally ill, kind of like a hospice, I guess, really. A place for them to go and die nicely. And she divorced from her husband. She had a couple of kids. I think two kids. I can't remember off the top of my head. So she then ended up moving to a farm in 1990. And she wanted to create a hospice for kids with AIDS, like children with AIDS. And I've read one place children with AIDS. I've read somewhere else babies with AIDS. But that didn't go very well. It was the 90s. And her house burned down in mysterious circumstances. Except somewhere else, it said that a community member burned down the house.
No way.
Yeah. And also, another article says that she had opposition in the community, which prevented her from. It says here, prevented her vision from being fully realized.
Is this is this opposition, you think, because of the sort of what's the word?
Oh, AIDS is a gay plague.
Yeah, the idea that it's like there's a lot of, even though it's then not actually communicable unless you share blood or other bodily fluids, people didn't necessarily know that yet, and they thought it was like this, like, but they did kind of know that.
I think by the 90s they knew it. I think
Diana had done the handshake and stuff.
Yeah, but that was like, we still talk about a lady bloody shaking someone with like HIV's hands,
that was good of her.
Bloody, that's insane.
Well,
right?
But it was a big
moment. It was a big moment.
Even
but that's,
it's
insane.
Just a lady shaking someone's hand.
No, but that's what I'm saying. It's so insane that like that was such a seminal moment that we still talk about it now.
Mm.
When looking back, there was no reason to believe necessarily that you could catch HIV just by shaking someone's hand. Do you know what I mean?
Right. So maybe it wasn't a particularly bold move on her part in that way. In a health way.
It wasn't health. It was more she was saying, you're a person and I'm going to treat you as such. I'm not going to treat you as dirty or contaminated or inhuman.
Yeah.
That, you know, I mean, that's the kind of point, I guess. But also it's just bloody bad. We're going to do this year.
But I don't
have it planned.
Really understand why. I mean, like if by that point it was known that it wasn't contagious in that sense.
Homophobia.
Well, I know, I understand it. Okay. I do know that. Well, number one, I do know that. Yes, thank you, Corey. I am aware of that. But
coming for the science facts.
Yeah, but if you're making a hospice for babies, it's not like those babies are
babies.
Like, no, well, but
oh, sorry, it was abandoned babies.
Abandoned babies.
Not babies with AIDS.
It says,
I don't understand how a person could ever be against abandoned babies with a horrible disease having a nice place to die. No, thank you. Burn it down. What the hell is wrong with you?
So these were abandoned babies with AIDS.
Of all the causes to be fine
sorry,
with.
But that reads like a Family Guy joke. Like, oh,
yeah, sure.
I'm building a hospice for abandoned babies with AIDS. Like, yeah. Not even HIV.
It's like
AIDS.
Saddest thing, and then another sad thing, and then another sad
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, and like in the 90s, AIDS was the one.
I hope whoever burned that building down is having a very bad day.
They just think the babies were gay.
That was my point. Is it just the association of like, oh, HIV, oh, gay, oh, don't like it, burn it down. What's wrong with people? And also, it's not contagious, and we know it's not.
I mean, it is.
Sorry, not contagious. Like, if you live nearby, you'll be fine.
Yeah, it's not. It's sort of like incidentally. It's only contagious through these very specific actions.
Yes.
Like, you know, sharing needles and all that sort of stuff. And also, nowadays, like, this wasn't the case in the 90s, obviously, but nowadays, I feel the need to say that HIV is incredibly treatable. If you are a homosexual bloke, speak to your doc. Get yourself on some PrEP.
Yep.
Avoid getting HIV. There you go.
And we will do a bisexual bloke as well. Also,
oh wow,
yeah,
look at me. Check.
That implicates the
check and pansexual woman.
Yeah. And pansexual bloke.
Look, if you're a bloke, if you're doing any, if okay, if you are a person who is engaging in sexual or otherwise engaging in sexual activity or activity that is otherwise putting you at an increased risk of contracting HIV, then please speak to your doctor about PrEP.
Is HIV still more prevalent in the gay community than it is in the wider population?
I think so, yeah. But
right.
It's just because of the method.
Mm-hmm.
You have sex.
Yeah, right? Of course. Yeah. No, yeah, I get it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. So we will do it actually this year. I've got it planned. I've got it down to the date. I know exactly when we're doing it. An episode on the AIDS pandemic.
I thought you were gonna put us all on PrEP.
I have been doing that. Like, I've been slipping it into... Why do you think I give you guys water?
He preps us water every week.
Yeah, I honestly, it's tough to know exactly why, but so as I've said, in one article it said that her house burnt down, and in another article, yeah, in another article it says in 1994 after an arsonist burnt her house down,
bold,
yeah. So she helped open more than 50 hospices around the world. She opened the world's first prison hospice in 1985. God, she'd won a bunch of awards. She was 2007 inductee into the National Women's Hall of Fame. And as I've said, in 1994, she retired because an arsonist burnt her house down, and she had been trying to start an AIDS hospice for abandoned babies. And I guess someone really does not like abandoned
someone
babies.
Someone was not on board
AIDS.
With that. No.
No. Gosh, let those babies die. No. Let's just let them die in a really bad place, because I guess I'm a person that hates abandoned babies with AIDS.
Were there any casualties?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay.
So she then actually kind of lost a lot of her reputation. Like, her reputation started to like kind of drop because she started getting a little bit kooky. She wanted to look into near-death experiences, spirit mediums. She was involved with a psychic, I'm saying that in quotes, a psychic named Jay Barham. But there was a scandal in 1979. I'm reading this verbatim. There was a scandal in 1979 when it was revealed that he had non-consensually, with female participants during seances whilst pretending to be an afterlife entity. Wasn't great.
This is why you get, when you go for hypnosis, there's a camera that records it. You get the footage of it because you are being put into a state of heightened suggestibility.
Yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah, absolutely awful. This whole AIDS thing gets brought up in multiple sort of articles. And it's not good. After the sort of burning down of the farmhouse, she, or burning down of the house, she had a stroke the following day. It was the first of like a few strokes. And this is what's confusing to me. It said that she died at home, but it also said that she moved to a hospice in Arizona, like to be near her son, Ken. And maybe it was like her son's home in Arizona, but it's confusing. Like it's not clear where she...
Maybe it means that she died not in a hospital. Like she died at home with her family.
Yeah, but then there's another one that says that she died in a hospice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's conflicting.
Did she live in the hospice?
I mean, maybe. But then... Yeah,
so then she died at home.
In the hospice.
You know... Yeah, sure. I don't know. My point is that she died. I think it was in 2004. Mm. So it says she died in her home in Scottsdale, Arizona. And she was survived by her two children and her two grandchildren. Thought she had two children. But also, another place said that she died in August 2004 at an assisted living center in Scottsdale, Arizona. Conflicting information. Doesn't really matter where she died. It was in Scottsdale,
she
Arizona.
Died all over the place, apparently.
It was just in Scottsdale. Yeah. Just a number of different places in Scottsdale. So she actually called up and spoke to Oprah. Not too long, like sort of before she died. And it was the last interview that she did that was broadcast. She described her feelings about her death as just angry, angry, angry.
Is that one of the stages?
One of the stages.
Anger. It is one of the stages.
Is that the first one?
No.
Which one is it?
Second, I think.
Denial, anger, bargaining. Anger, I think, is second, yeah.
Mm.
We'll cover that in a second. And this is a quote from her son, Ken. Says, unfortunately, the public didn't want her to go through her own stages. They thought the great doctor of death and dying should just be some angelic person who arrives at acceptance from the get-go. But we all have to deal with grief and loss in different ways. And so this is, we'll get to this in a second. Sorry, I know I keep on saying that, but just we're almost finished with her life.
Yeah.
So she spent the last 9 years of her life living in Arizona, as we've said. And she wrote four more books in those last 9 years, one of which was on grief and grieving. And then she died, as I said, in August 2004. We don't know where, somewhere in Scottsdale, Arizona. And then in 2005, Ken Ross, who, as I've said, is her son, started the Elizabeth Kugler Ross Foundation. And they do stuff. It's not important. I might talk about it if we do an episode on her, whatever. So let's talk about the Kugler Ross model or the five stages of grief. Doesn't matter what you call it. Both are acceptable. It means the same thing. So a quote from her is, everything was huge and very depersonalized, very technical. And that was what she said to the BBC in an interview in 1983, talking about the hospitals that she worked in dealing with dying patients. She then went on to say, patients who were terminally ill were literally left alone. Nobody talked to them. Was this during the AIDS pandemic in the 80s? Well, I mean, that's definitely something that happened during the AIDS pandemic in the 80s. Mm. Especially, it was particularly compounded then because, one, no one wanted to touch them because they thought we were dirty. And you actually saw this whole thing of, like, a lot of lesbians would come out and spend time with people dying of AIDS before they died.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, which is really lovely. So she started running, as I said, she ran that seminar she then started doing those interviews with people with terminally ill patients. Then she wrote the book on death and dying, and that was where she first described the Kubler-Ross method, or the five stages of grief. And this was based on terminally ill patients who knew they were going to die, right? So people talk about the five stages of grief as being, oh, someone I know has died, and then I go through the five stages of grief. But actually initially came about as looking at terminally ill people and how they dealt with the concept of their own impending death.
Right.
Yeah. And so she noticed that she basically made up this model wherein people tended to have these five reactions of death, like coming up. And she then kind of realized that this could apply to more kinds of loss, because obviously it is kind of a similar thing. Like, you are losing your life. Other people have lost. Yeah, you have lost someone else.
I think about this a lot, which is really weird, which is we don't really think about the fact that on both sides of dying, you're never going to see the person again. So if you're like married, or it's your parent, or it's your child, or whatever, the person dying has to mourn every person in their life because they're never going to see those people again. Obviously, they also assume they're not going to experience, but like, whilst they are experiencing, they have to sort of, they come to terms with the fact that I'm attached to these people and I'm going to not see them again.
This is the last time.
That's a really interesting way to look at it, because I have always thought, do you know in films where someone sacrifices their life for someone else?
Yeah.
Like, okay, so let's say Avengers Endgame. I know we've been putting it a lot, but Avengers Endgame, where, spoilers, Hawkeye and Black Widow are fighting each other to decide which one of them gets to die.
Love that scene.
It's a fantastic scene. also selfish, right? Like, I think, honestly, being the choosing to be the one that dies is the most selfish thing that you can do, because you don't need to deal with it.
You get to be the hero. You don't have to,
You don't have to deal with, let's put it this way. I am Black Widow or Hawkeye, right? Oh, I'm Hawkeye, right? And my friend Black Widow has just gone ahead and beat the crap out of me and thrown herself off the Soulstone cliff. Now, one, I've lost my friend. Sucks. Yeah. And two, I need to keep on living and deal with the loss of my friend. Selfish Black Widow. Really bloody selfish. Let Clint die. And he doesn't need to deal with any of the stuff that he's done.
Yeah.
Right? It is the selfless thing to do.
Another one of Corey's hot takes.
No. And then we might not have had a Black Widow film that felt 4 years too late.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We could have had a Hawkeye series that felt 4 years too late. No, the Hawkeye series was actually great. I really enjoyed it. Yeah, it was good. Anyway, so seriously though, like I think it's interesting that we don't think about it that way. Mm. That we don't think about, like, oh well, with the death generally, I mean, on some level, your experience ends, and we see that as being far scarier or far worse than a continued experience. That's why I think the death penalty, on top of being inhumane and, like, something we shouldn't ever do, I think it's a crappy punishment.
It doesn't work.
It's like, it's a crappy punishment. It's like, yeah. Oh, what would you rather do? Experience nothing or experience terrible stuff for a much longer period of time?
Wow, boring stuff. Yeah, boredom.
I think jail is pretty terrible.
I think it's pretty terrible, but I think that the idea of going to jail is isolation from society as opposed to the fact that it's crap in there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I mean, I'm talking about the sort of subjective experience of, you know, if you're, let's say you've got the death penalty, right?
Mm.
It's awful, awful experience. Like, oh no, I'm going to die. That's scary. And then you're dead.
That's it.
Compared to, like, let's say you've got a life sentence of, like, 40.
I'm wasting away.
Like 40, 60 years of just like you're not going anywhere. Just a complete. It would suck, right? And I feel
like looking around this room, you're like, I'm in here for longer than I've actually been alive so far.
Right? I feel like that is so much worse than death.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think that it is really interesting that we don't think of that somehow culturally we've seen death as this ultimate bad thing when, like.
Yeah.
Hey, there are worse things.
It's at worst, nothing.
Yeah, right?
At best, something.
Right? Like, come on, let's be real here. I'm not saying that anyone should yearn for death. I'm just saying there are worse things. Dumbledore is maybe right. There are things that are worse than death.
Yeah.
Being in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That should have been Voldemort's real fear.
Standing on Lego. Barefoot.
Wow. Imagine if you just got all the worst things and you made Voldemort experience them all.
Wait. Jam, can I just point out that what you have just implied is that you would rather die than step foot on Lego?
For hundreds of years, yeah.
Oh, no, you didn't give a
just
time.
Once.
No, just the one time.
You gave no indication of number of times or length of time.
No, just the one time.
You live in a very volatile world, I'll say that. Sorry, I'm just making sure. You know the meme of the guy doesn't know which button to press?
Yeah.
It's Jam. One of the buttons is Lego. One of the buttons is die. So that's how the five stages of grief sort of came about, just through interviews, many interviews with terminally ill patients. And it was initially applied to your own death, but then obviously it was expanded to talk about other forms of loss, other forms of bereavement.
Such as the Star Wars movie.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
It was real bad.
I don't know why you're looking at me like I'm being sarcastic. I am being sarcastic. And you think that's a ridiculous suggestion.
Because you're, I swear to God, if you went through the same thing that I did, you would feel the same.
I went through it with the Fantastic Beasts series.
Oh, God.
I went through that because that hurt.
Imagine the Fantastic Beasts series, right? But you had a really... The last one was really good and it led directly into that fantastic. Imagine the last Harry Potter film was incredible.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic. And it set up everything Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah.
And then they just swept it all away and did something.
That would hurt.
It was so, painful.
Oh
my God. I can still remember speaking to Connie before it. And Connie was like, how is it? And Connie was like, it's real bad. And I had my
Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah, Rise of Skywalker. I had my expectations so low for Rise of Skywalker, and it was worse. So the Kubler-Ross model, or the five stages of grief, we've gone over kind of how it was discovered how it was. She discovered it in a
moment. She unearthed it.
Like Moses.
Yes, exactly.
What, they unearthed Moses? What?
Yeah. Yeah, man.
He wasn't born.
They found him on the top of the mountain.
They actually found him in a river, in a little basket.
Okay.
That is the story of Moses.
That is the story of Moses.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I know my Moses stories. I watched the King of Egypt, Prince of Egypt. I watched the thing. Anyway, so she came up with the five stages of grief. We've gone over how that came about, but let's go over what the five stages are. So first, you've got denial. And in the denial phase, yeah, you deny the loss. Bear in mind.
As in, like, literally, like, this person has died. No, they haven't.
So let's expand it out from just death. So bear in mind that the five stages of grief can apply to any kind of loss. Like, I mean, loss of a job, loss of a limb, loss of a loved one, loss of a very, very tasty cookie, perhaps.
Oh, God.
Yeah, right?
It's the worst.
Tell you what, this is interesting, actually. I started noticing for a while, if I have a bad dream where something bad happens, I, like, deny that it's happened. And then I wake up because I'm like, this hasn't happened. I must be dreaming, right? And I did that for a while to wake myself up from bad dreams. And then, like, a bad thing happened in real life and my brain was like, this isn't happening. And I expected to wake up and then I didn't.
Oh, that's really depressing. That's really depressing. I've had this thing where bad things happen and then sometimes I dream that a solution has happened. So let's say I lost my AirPods.
Tragic.
And I dreamed that, I found them. It was just under my bed. And sometimes, you know, you do find, I've lost this thing and I find it. So often it's just a dream and
you
wake up being
twice.
So confused.
You lose
it's
them
awful.
When you lose them and then you dream that you found them and then you wake up and that was a dream and you grieve again.
Yeah. But also sometimes I don't immediately remember that the dream is just sitting in the back of my mind because it's just in the back of my mind. It's just, oh yeah, I found it. And then I go to get it and I'm like, oh.
I think that might be denial actually.
That's absolutely denied true.
That you've lost them.
So the first stage is obviously denial, as Lucas so handily told us.
I went through the denial stage with The Rise of Skywalker where I watched it, the midnight premiere. Did not like it, but I couldn't accept that it was actually that bad. So I went back the next day and I came out of it going, yeah, no, it was actually really good, actually.
You know what? I'm still actually going through that with the first Fantastic Beasts movie. I'm still like, I'm fully intending to watch it again going, I must have seen it wrong, right? There'll be something really good in there.
Fantastic Beasts had good stuff in it. Rise of Skywalker. Not to try and compare. I mean, like, as in, I think that's the reason why with Fantastic Beasts, I kind of got over it really quick.
Mm.
It's Rise of Skywalker. There's just nothing.
Second time I went to see it by myself, just trying to convince myself that it was actually good. And then on the third watch, I was like, no, this is bad.
It's bad. No. So denial is kind of like shock. And you have a sort of difficulty really feeling like it's real, right? So do you know that kind of like, oh God, like this thing has happened. You kind of forget that it's happened or you like, it's really difficult to like, get yourself to remember this thing has happened. This is my new life now. Like, I am now no longer waiting for Rise of Skywalker to come out and for it to be this awesome film. Now have to live in a world where the culmination to the Star Wars sequels is that film. Mess.
Yeah.
And it's hard to come to terms with. And I wrote a YouTube video about this, like, ages ago that I've still not made, but I think I'm gonna make I think actually it'll come out maybe a little bit before
alongside this episode.
I wrote it and then you've got anger. So the quote that goes with denial, I found these quotes, I think, from the NHS. I can't remember, links in the description. So I found this quote that says, no, not me, it cannot be true, right? That's the sort of vibe. And then you've got anger, and then that's like when the reality of the thing sinks in. You can just feel bitter. You can feel unfair.
Like, why me?
Like, feel like it's unfair. Exactly. That's literally the quote that I've got there. Is why it? Me?
Why me?
And that's exactly what I felt with. And I'm going to use The Rise of Skywalker because it is so visceral for me, and also it's not too macabre and depressing. It's very depressing, but only for a certain few. With Rise of Skywalker, I was very much feeling like,
why this series of all series?
For crying out loud, JJ, like, why? Why did you have to? Why did they have to bring JJ back? Why did they have to ruin it? Why did you have to do it to this series? Like, especially when, like, I hadn't been that invested in Star Wars before. When I went in to see The Last Jedi, I wasn't super invested. Like, I liked Star Wars, like, I really enjoyed Star Wars, but if it was a bad film, I wouldn't care. And then The Last Jedi got me so invested. I was like, I cannot wait to see where this goes because it was the best Star Wars film. It subverted my expectations, and it was like such a Star Wars film, but everything was twisted, turned on its head.
Yeah.
And then J.J. Abrams just came in and just was like, okay, blah, blah, blah.
What do fans like?
Exactly. And then bargaining. And that's the point where it's sort of with death. It's like you sort of feel like you want to postpone it, or like feel like you want to make a deal for more time, or like you can change your lifestyle to try and be like, yeah, I can try, and if I do this, maybe it will change, right? And for me with The Rise of Skywalker, I was like, well, maybe they'll make another one. Maybe they'll fix it. Like, maybe if there's a fan outcry or like petition or like restore the Snyderverse type thing, like,
yeah.
Which, by the way, when the Zack Snyder film came out, of like the Zack Snyder Justice League film came out, that renewed hope a little bit for me. Like, maybe they'll do the same with Rise of Skywalker.
Disney won't budge on that. No,
Disney won't budge on anything. That's why Disney don't have like. That's why there's not been a single director's cut. That's been like super publicly well known or available for any of the MCU films. Disney do not do that. Yeah. They do. Mm-mm. So yeah, great. Like that was my case of bargaining. And that's like the sort of quote that they've got here is like trying to postpone death or change the thing with good behavior, right? Like you feel like you can have some effect on this inevitable thing that has happened or will happen.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what where bargaining is. Then you've got depression, which, oh boy, that was a tough one. We all know what depression is. And that's like, in case of sort of dying people, this is where people like can be hopeless, feel isolated. And when this is like people sort of preparing themselves for death. And for me, this was me preparing myself for a world where, gosh darn it.
You had to accept that the Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah.
Do you think we're belittling grief at all here?
No, I genuinely felt I've gone through multiple I've grieved for like actual bereavements of, you know, like people and pets and whatnot. But like I think like I've felt very similar feelings with the Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah.
Like I'm being fully honest. Like I think it's a good thing to bring this up because you can grieve many things. It doesn't need to be like
the world you thought you were going to be in.
Yeah.
And more generally, whether that's with a person in it or with a certain film in it.
Yeah.
It's the you're grieving the state of the world.
Mm.
Whether it's, you know, a global pandemic or the fact that this one Star Wars movie came out.
Yeah.
It is all inside the state of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And like obviously I'm not saying that this, you know, The Rise of Skywalker was meant as much to me as anything else, but like, I mean, I felt grief. I had expectations and they were like I felt it. It was very odd.
Yeah.
So those are the sort of those are the four stages. Then we've got the fifth, obviously, acceptance, and that's the final stage. It's kind of said to be the final stage. They acknowledge you acknowledge the mortality, or you kind of acknowledge the event that has happened or will happen, and you kind of are prepared for it, or you start preparing for it, or you start to move on from it, sort of thing. And that's acceptance. We know what acceptance is, right? It's like, you know, you come to terms with it. And so those are the five stages. Now, I've said them in that order, and people always say them in order, but you don't need to experience them in order. I mean, Kubler-Ross, like she specifically said that, you know, they were not meant to be in order. Like her son said about it, the five stages are meant to be a loose framework. They're not some sort of recipe or ladder for conquering grief. If people wanted to use different theories or different models, she didn't care. She just wanted to begin the conversation. And this is the thing, like people, I think, misunderstand it quite a lot. They think, the five stages of grief. Every single person, whenever they grieve, goes through these five stages in this exact order. It's very clean cut. But ultimately, these are just observations he made about five general emotions that people have when they're going through this experience, like experiencing loss.
Okay, so it's not actually the idea that her model isn't necessarily reflected in the clinical data or in empirical data. Mm-hmm. It's actually our understanding of her model that is not reflected. Like her model was more vague and more sort of like, these are some things that some people experience. You might not experience them in the right order, or you might not experience all of them.
Mm.
Whereas it's what your like your issue is actually with the kind of pop psychology version of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, well, this is what frustrates me as well. That there was also a study done, I think, in 2007, like the first sort of one that was very large. That was like a sort of longitudinal study that looked at people over the course of like their grieving process, and that study found that that study basically corroborated the sort of Kubler-Ross model, but it's been heavily criticized. And I've looked at it and it just seems a little bit like it seems like they found what they were looking for. Do you know what I mean?
So when you say it corroborated the Kubler-Ross model? Do you mean it corroborated like the pop psychology version?
Pop psychology in order, yeah.
And actually, what would be called officially the Kubler-Ross model is not that.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And it is interesting to me that it reminds me of the Myers-Briggs type indicator, those personality tests, yeah. Wherein, this is something that is like almost exactly the same here. So we were talking about the Myers-Briggs test and how that is used as a sort of corporate thing. It's used in companies to see who is good for management. And ultimately, the Myers-Briggs test doesn't tell you how good someone is at anything. It just tells you maybe kind of what they fall back on, what they kind of rely on, like what traits they rely on. With the five stages of grief, or the Kubler-Ross model, it doesn't give you an exact roadmap of here is exactly how you feel. It just tells you these are some emotions that people experience when going through loss, yeah. And you can experience some of them or all of them in like really kind of any order or any intensity. But these are generalized emotions that you would feel. But ultimately, I think it's really odd that like this is something that is so. I mean, I understand why people latch onto it, but for me, it seems odd to sort of venerate this so much because the work that she did was fantastic. But ultimately, you can apply a general set of emotions to sort of almost anything that all humans go through. Because every single person goes through a loss at some point in their life, right? You can generalize almost any experience like that, right? And I understand the value of it to some degree,
yeah.
But I don't understand how in sort of pop science and pop culture, it's become such a sort of ubiquitous and rigid model. You know?
Yeah.
I guess the thing I find interesting about it is like, so you've got, for example, denial the first time. The first one's denial, and then bargaining was it. So like, I guess I would find it interesting to have this put into terms of like, rather than the subjective experience, put into terms of like, almost psychiatry about, I don't know if it would be psychology, like I'm not a psychiatrist, but like in terms of like, I guess put into terms of like how I would understand it, for example, I would think about it in terms of like your brain's internal representation of the world and its sort of inertia, like not wanting to shift to it's inertia, not wanting to is the wrong phrase, but the fact that when a large change to your world happens, the internal model of the world that your brain has sort of at first it just tries not to shift or struggles to shift and then it tries to change it. It tries to go, oh, is there anything I can do that actually will shift the world, the way the world is, back to the state it was before? And then I can't remember the other ones.
I get you.
That put in those sort of terms, I'd find that really interesting.
I mean, I think the way that it's kind of was used, I think probably one of the best ways for it to be used is it's spoken about clinically in a lot of cases. Like, you know, you can literally just search Kubler-Ross method in and then name sort of like any anything that doctors might be looking at someone for. Like, it's been looked at in sort of cancer. It's been looked at in diabetes.
Oh, wow.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like, as in, you can apply it to that. And I think the best way it seems to be used is loosely to understand how to deal with people sort of clinically. You know, like as in some emotions people might go through when they experience like say the loss of a limb or suddenly becoming disabled or basically any major adjustment wherein the person feels like they have lost something. It makes sense to like kind of like look at that and be like, these are general things that people could be going through. But one way that I hate that it's used, and again I brought up the Myers-Briggs test, is because it's used in corporations. It's used in the BBC, IBM, to help people, to help employees go through periods of change. It's the Kubler-Ross change curve, and it is a very linear thing, and it shows where people, it basically shows someone's sort of emotional sort of state, productivity, or like, you know, ability to work.
Really?
On a curve based on
like
the Kubler-Ross method.
When they'll be back to work at full capacity.
Yeah. And I just,
predict acceptance, the acceptance period.
Yeah, it just, to me, it doesn't seem to be all that predictive.
God.
But this is something that has been seen, is that people seem to be more able to deal with loss and reach that sort of acceptance when they have a longer period of time to come to terms with it. And also, acceptance seems to be one of the most common things that people experience. And I mean, other than like people experiencing sort of like trauma, right? Because, like, you know, through grief, right, there's traumatic grief. We went through PTSD, right? Like, that you've got, what is it, not like a, like, you know, most, like, a lot of people will go through a sort of traumatic experience, but not everyone will get PTSD. And it's kind of similar.
It depends on how quickly, like, if you can get treatment quite quickly, then you'll be less likely to have PTSD.
Yeah, but also, like, also just a predisposition. There are people that are predisposed, yeah.
Okay.
And this, I think, the same goes for sort of grief, wherein, like, some people can, some people will not, like, will reach acceptance a lot quicker than others.
We talked about this on After Dark.
We did talk about this on After Dark. Yeah,
we talked about it in I won't spoil it too much, but we talked about it in context of aphantasia.
Yeah,
about the inability to recall somebody visually, meaning that you're less affected by. Or, like, you seem less affected than other people who have the memory of the lost person constantly called into their mind.
Yeah.
Mm. And so then, according to this one psychologist / psychiatrist, I'm not sure, who I saw interviewed, people with aphantasia sometimes state that they feel that they move past grief faster than other people.
Yeah.
Specifically the grief of a lost loved one.
Yeah.
Mm. And that was the November episode of After Dark. After Dark being our... I can't even say new anymore. It's been going for a good few months. It's our show over on Patreon. It's an exclusive show to our patrons, wherein we don't necessarily talk about science, the conversation after Sci Guys. It doesn't end. We just keep on recording it. Talk about philosophy. We sometimes touch on science, philosophy, politics, anything like that. It's a good time. Go to our Patreon, check it out. So, I mean, the Kubler-Ross model. I mean, I hope I've kind of got this across, that she kind of came up with it as not necessarily this, like, sort of empirical, like, very strict guideline for how people sort of will experience loss, but more through her conversations, she had these observations and she laid it out. And a quote here from Charles Corr, who I don't actually have who that is. Oh, my goodness. An academic, I think someone studying in that sort of field. So he says, in some ways, if she had never used the word stage and said that there were five of them, maybe we would have been better off. But people might not have paid as much attention to her. And that is it, right? Like, the fact that we kind of view the five stages of grief as these distinct five stages, like literally the Simpsons episode, one fish, two fish, blowfish, bluefish. No, I didn't have to look it up. It's the episode. It's the second season. 11th episode, I think. That one I did know because I looked up, because I just wanted to double check to make sure that I had the right.
You're a nerd, man.
Well, I wanted to make sure. But yeah, so one fish, two fish, blowfish, bluefish. Homer eats the wrong part of a blowfish. Yeah. And they think he's eating the wrong part of a blowfish, and they think he's going to die. And he goes through the five stages of grief all in one go, although they swap, I think, they swap one of them for fear. I think it might be depression for fear. And he runs through them all in that one go. And that's a joke there, right? But the joke there obviously depends on the fact that everybody knows the five stages of grief. And everybody thinks that you go through the five stages of grief. And, like...
That's very interesting that fear is not one. Because that would surely be in impending death, and also in the death of somebody close to you who you relied on. Fear is quite a big thing.
I think it's too nonspecific.
Okay.
No, I mean, like, as in, that's what I mean. Like, I think that fear is too nonspecific in... Because there's, like denial and bargaining can both come out of fear.
Mm,
anger can come out of fear. Fear leads to hate.
Donnie Darko.
Yoda.
Fear and love. Oh, that's Yoda.
Yeah.
I was thinking Donnie Darko.
No.
The whole fear, love.
Oh, I was talking dynamic. Yoda, where it's like, the fear leads to something, and something leads to hate, and hate, blah, blah, blah. So...
The dark side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that is kind of the overview of the five stages of grief. And that's kind of like my issue that I have with it. Not the issue with the model itself, but more with the way that the model has been taken in pop culture to be this strict guideline for how everyone should feel. If you want to use the five stages of grief to give you a sort of like, guide to how you're like to understand your feelings when you're going through a loss, that's great. And that's fantastic. Use it if it helps you. But if you're going to use it prescriptively, okay, this is what we say so often, right? If you're going to use it prescriptively, then that is a no bueno, right? It's a descriptive model. But when you try to use it prescriptively by saying, this is how you will feel, this order, this way, no bueno. It just doesn't work that way. And I don't think it was ever intended to work that way. I had some quotes from her book, but honestly, I don't think we really need them. I'm just going to quickly talk to you about some other, because let you know that there are other models for the stages of grief.
Ooh.
Yeah. And, you know, there's the Bowlby and Parks four phases of grief. That's shock and disbelief, searching and yearning, disorganization and repair, and rebuilding and healing. And yearning, obviously, is like yearning for a time. Yeah. And that's another really sort of not popular, but like that's another really common experience, like yearning for that time, which I guess you can kind of say is
sort of denial.
It's kind of denial, it's kind of bargaining, but it's because it's not really either of them, it is its own kind of distinct thing there.
Yeah.
You've got Warden's four basic tasks in adapting to loss. There's accepting the reality of loss, experiencing pain of grief, adjusting to environment, and redirecting emotional energy. And then okay. Silverman and Class, which is the continuing bonds idea. They don't see that the grief is ever culminating in closure or like ever being like entirely resolved. The idea is that people just and I'm going to read this verbatim. It says they propose that rather than letting go, the bereaved person negotiates and renegotiates the meaning of their loss over time. Death is permanent. However, grieving and mourning can maintain the presence of the deceased in the web of the family. They are remembered and not forgotten. They continue to have a role in the memories of the bereaved. And then there's the strobe and shut dual process, and that's essentially this sort of back and forth between loss orientation and restoration. Essentially, that you sort of focus on plans or activities that will get you back to like sort of normal until when focusing on the loss is like too much. And then because both of those sort of things are really difficult things to do, they're both like very taxing, you switch between them. So you focus on doing all these things to get back to normal, and that becomes too stressful, and boom, you go back to focusing on the loss, and then that becomes too stressful, and boom, you go back to the other one. And it's this trying to avoid it and then confronting it and avoiding it and confronting it and avoiding it and confronting
in
it
in waves. Yeah.
And I think they all work. I don't think like people are complex, right? And I think they all are general enough to describe people's experiences. This is where I think this is kind of difficult. You can apply that kind of thinking to any emotional experience, like I've said. There's not really any empirical data on it, and it's like, and the data that there is really widely criticized, and it makes sense because it's really hard to study this because there is that kind of subjectivity to it, right? And if you're looking for a particular model, you're probably going to find it because at some point people are going to be experiencing these emotions, right? And I think the bit that really winds me up the most is the fact that culturally it is basically the same as Stockholm Syndrome or the Myers-Briggs personality indicator or the type indicator, wherein people have just taken this thing and run with it. And it's basically broken the usage of it. It makes it not as useful as it could or should be. And I think I'll end on what I think the most important thing that you should take away from the Kubler-Ross model is that you should listen to people that you're trying to help. That's how she built that model, by listening to people when nobody else was listening to them. And hear from them what they're experiencing and what they want and need. And you'll probably come off a little bit better. And that's it.
Very good.
Shall we move on to a quick fire quiz?
Dun, 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 dun. Grieving edition.
Well, very somber, very solemn. Mm. I will solemnly tell you the rules of the quick fire quiz. They are the same as always. I will read out the question. I will have to finish reading the question before you can buzz in with your answer. It is one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer wins. And what do they win, Jamp?
Nothing.
You're goddamn right. So,
whoa, reset the energy.
Luke, what is your buzzer?
Oh.
Jamp, what is your buzzer?
Bong.
How's that? Church bell.
Funeral bell. Yeah. Very good.
What are the five stages of grief in the usual order?
Bong.
Go on, you can take this.
Jamp.
Stage one, denial.
Yes.
Stage two, anger.
Yes.
Stage three, bargaining.
Wow, yes.
Wow.
Stage four, depression.
Yes.
Whoa.
Stage five, acceptance.
Ding, 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 ding.
Wow, you deserve the hell out of that. Well done.
If anyone is counting, I'm going to give that 5 points. That is incredible.
What? Whoa.
That was just five things in order. That was good.
Stage.
I think it's actually 25 points because it's five things in the correct order and the 25 possible orders. So well done.
Thank you. So all the extra points are the ones that I didn't say because
they're not correct. Then it
should be 30. Mm, nah, I think 25 is enough. Okay. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Let's not get too silly.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's it, unless you two want to add anything to the end of this one.
Five more points. It's 30 now.
Hey! Thank you. 5 points to Gryffindor.
Well, before we go, we would like to thank all of our patrons and thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday, and why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod on patreon.com/psychguys, or you can join the community over on our Discord, or you can get some of our merch over at normalcitizen.store, or you can find and contact us at psychguyspod on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, or send us an email at psychguyspod@gmail.com.
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 You can follow me at Notgar everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
And goodbye.
I'm sorry for your loss.
The loss at the end of this episode.
You have to grieve till next week.
Goodbye.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.